weed from the American South. The weed had thoroughly stabilized the cliff face, but it was now attacking the trees near the cliff, and Jack periodically had to go after them with a weed eater to save the trees from being smothered. But that wasn't a problem this time of year. Ryan's lot was half open and half wooded. The part near the road had once been farmed, though not easily, as the ground was not flat enough to drive a tractor across it safely. As he approached his house, the trees began, some gnarled old oaks and other deciduous trees whose leaves were gone now, leaving skeletal branches to reach out into the thin, cold air. As he approached the carport, he saw that Kathy was already home, her Porsche and the family wagon parked in the carport. He had to leave his rabbit in the open. "Daddy!" Sally yanked open the door and ran out without her jacket to meet her father. "It's too cold out here," Jack told his daughter. "No, isn't," Sally replied. She grabbed his briefcase and carried it with two hands, puffing as she climbed up the three steps into the house. Ryan got out of his coat and hung it in the entry closet. As with everything else, it was hard to do with one hand. He was cheating a little now. As with steering the car, he was starting to use his left hand, careful to avoid putting any strain on his shoulder. The pain was completely gone now, but Ryan was sure that he could bring it back quickly enough if he did something dumb. Besides which, Kathy would yell at him. He found his wife in the kitchen. She was looking at the pantry and frowning. "Hi, honey."
"Hi, Jack. You're late."
"So are you." Ryan kissed his wife. Kathy smelled his breath. Her nose crinkled.
"How's Robbie?"
"Fine. And I just had two very light ones."
"Uh-huh."
She turned back to the pantry.
"What do you want for dinner?"
"Surprise me," Jack suggested.
"You're a big help. I ought to let you fix it."
"It's not my turn, remember?"
"I knew I should have stopped at the Giant," Kathy groused.
"How was work?"
"Only one procedure. I assisted Bernie on a cornea transplant, then I had to take the residents around for rounds. Dull day. Tomorrow'll be better. Bernie says hi, by the way. How does Franks and Beans grab you?"
Jack laughed. Ever since they came back, their diet had consisted mainly of basic American staples, and it was a little late for something fancy.
"Okay. I'm going to change and punch up something on the computer for a few minutes." "Careful with the arm, Jack."
"Five times a day, she warns me." Jack sighed. "Never marry a doctor." The Ryan home was a deckhouse design. The living dining room had a cathedral ceiling that peaked 16 feet over the carpeted floor with an enormous wood beam. A wall of triple-paned windows faced the bay, with a large deck beyond the sliding glass doors. Opposite the glass was a massive brick fireplace that reached through the roof. The master bedroom was half a level above the living room, with a window that enabled one to look down into it. Ryan trotted up the steps. The house design accommodated large closets. Ryan selected casual clothes and went through the annoying ritual of changing himself one-handed. He was still experimenting, trying to find an efficient way to do it. Finished, he went back down and curved around the stairs to the next level down, his library. It was a large one. Jack read a lot, and also purchased books he didn't have time to read, banking against the time when he would. He had a large desk up against the windows on the bay side of the house. Here was his personal computer, an Apple, and all of its peripheral equipment. Ryan flipped it on and started typing in instructions. Next, he put his modem online and placed a call into CompuServe. The time of day guaranteed easy access, and he selected MicroQuote 2 from the entry menu. A moment later, he was looking at Holoware Limited's stock performance over the past 3 years. The stock was agreeably unimpressive, fluctuating from $2 to as much as $6, but that was 2 years back. It was a company which had once held great promise, but somewhere along the way investors had lost confidence. Jack made a note, then exited the program and got into another, Disclosure 2, to look at the company's SEC filings and last annual report. "Okay," Ryan told himself. The company was making money, but not very much.
One problem with high-tech issues was that so many investors wanted big returns very quickly, or they'd move on to something else, forgetting that things didn't necessarily happen that way. This company had found a small, though somewhat precarious niche, and was ready to try something bold. Ryan made a mental estimate of what the Navy contract would be worth, and compared it with the company's total revenues. Okay, he told himself before exiting the system completely and shutting his computer down. Next, he called his broker. Ryan worked through a discount brokerage firm that had people on duty around the clock. Jack always dealt with the same man. Hi, Mort, it's Jack. How's the family? Hello again, Dr. Ryan. Everything's fine with us. What can we do for you tonight? An outfit called Holoware, one of the high-tech bunch on Highway 128 outside Boston. It's on the Amex. Okay. Ryan heard tapping on a keyboard. Everyone used computers. Here it is. Going at 4 7/8. Not a very active issue. Until lately. There has been some modest activity over the past month. What kind? Ryan asked. This was another sign to look for. Oh, I see. The company is buying itself back a little. No big deal. But they're buying their own stock out. Bingo. Ryan smiled to himself. Thank you, Robbie. You gave me a tip on a real-life one. Jack asked himself if this constituted trading on inside information. His initial tip might be called that, but his decision to buy was based on confirmation made legally, on the basis of his experience as a stock trader. Okay. It's legal. He could do whatever he wanted. How much do you think you can get for me? It's not a very impressive stock. How often am I wrong, Mort? How much do you want? At least 20K, and if there's more, I want all of it you can find. There was no way he'd get hold of more than 50,000 shares, but Ryan made a snap decision to grab all he could. If he lost, it was only money. And it had been over a year since he'd last had a hunch like this one. If they got the Navy contract, that stock would increase in value tenfold. The company must have had a tip, too. Buying back their own stock on the slim resources they had would, if Ryan was guessing right, dramatically increase the firm's capital, enabling a rapid expansion of operations. Holoware was betting on the future, and betting big. There was 5 seconds of silence on the phone. What do you know, Jack? The broker asked, finally. I'm playing a hunch. Okay. 20K plus. I'll call you at 10 tomorrow. You think I should? It's a toss of the dice, but I think it's a good toss. Thanks. Anything else? No. I have to go eat dinner. Good night, Mort. See ya. Both men hung up. At the far end of the phone, the broker decided that he'd go in for 1,000 shares, too. Ryan was occasionally wrong, but when he was right, he tended to be very right.
Christmas Day, O'Donnell said quietly. Perfect. Is that the day they're moving, Sean? McKenny asked. He leaves London by van at 4 a.m. That's bloody good news. I was afraid they'd use a helicopter. No word on the route they'll use.
He read on.
But they're going to take him across on the Lymington Ferry at 8:30 Christmas morning. Excellent timing, when you think about it. Too early for heavy traffic. Everyone will be opening his presents and getting dressed for church. The van might even have the ferry to itself. Who'd expect a prisoner transfer on Christmas Day?
So, we are going to break Sean out, then?
Michael, our men do us little good when they're inside, don't they? You and I are flying over tomorrow morning. I think we'll drive down to Lymington and look at the ferry.
Chapter 9. A Day for Celebration.
God, it'll be nice to have two arms again, Ryan observed.
2 more weeks, maybe 3, Kathy reminded him.
and keep your hands still inside the damn sling.
Yes, dear.
It was about 2 in the morning and things were going badly. And, well, part of the Ryan family tradition, a tradition barely 3 years old, but a tradition nevertheless, was that after Sally was in bed and asleep, her parents would creep down to the basement storage area, a room with a padlocked door, and bring the toys upstairs for assembly. The previous 2 years, this ceremony had been accompanied by a couple of bottles of champagne. Assembling toys was a wholly different sort of exercise when the assemblers were half-blasted. It was their method of relaxing into the Christmas spirit. So far, things had gone well. Jack had taken his daughter to the 7 o'clock children's mass at St. Mary's and gotten her to bed a little after 9. His daughter had slid her head around the fireplace wall only twice before a loud command from her father had banished her to her bedroom for good, her arm clasping an overly talkative A.G. bear to her chest. By midnight it was decided that she was asleep enough for her parents to make a little noise. This had begun the toy trek, as Kathy called it. Both parents removed their shoes to minimize noise on the hardwood steps and went downstairs. Of course, Jack forgot the key to the padlock and had to climb back upstairs to the master bedroom to search for it. 5 minutes later, the door was opened and the two of them made 4 trips each, setting up a lavish pile of multicolored boxes near the tree next to Jack's toolkit. "You know what the 2 most obscene words in the English language are, Kathy?" Ryan asked nearly 2 hours later. "Assembly required," his wife answered with a giggle. "Honey, last year I said that." "A small Phillips." Jack held his hand out. Kathy smacked the screwdriver into his hand like a surgical instrument. Both of them were sitting on the rug, 15 feet from the 8-foot tree. Around them was a crescent of toys, some in boxes, some already assembled by the now exasperated father of a little girl. "You want to let me do that?"
"This is man's work," her husband said. He sat the screwdriver down and sipped at a glass of champagne.
"You chauvinist pig. If I let you do this by yourself, you wouldn't be finished by Easter."
She was right, Jack told himself. Doing it half-drunk wasn't all that hard. Doing it one-handed was hard, but not insurmountable. Doing it one-handed and half-drunk was... The damn screws didn't want to stay in the plastic, and the instructions for putting a V8 engine together had to be easier than this. "Why is it that a doll needs a house?" Jack asked plaintively. "I mean, the friggin' doll's already in a house, isn't she?"
"It must be hard, being a chauvinist pig. You dodos just don't understand anything," Kathy noted sympathetically. "I guess men never get over baseball bats. All those simple, one-piece toys."
Jack's head turned slowly. "Well, the least you could do is have another glass of wine."
"One's the weekly limit, Jack. I did have a big glass," she reminded him.
"And made me drink the rest."
"You bought the bottle, Jack." She picked it up. "Big one, too."
Ryan turned back to the Barbie dollhouse. He thought he remembered when the Barbie doll had been invented. A simple, rather curvy doll, but still just a damn doll, something the girls played with. It hadn't occurred to him then that he might someday have a little girl of his own. "The things we do for our kids," he told himself. Then he laughed quietly at himself. "Of course we do, and we enjoy it. Tomorrow this will be a funny memory, like the Christmas morning last year when I nearly put this very screwdriver through the palm of my hand." If he didn't enlist his wife's assistance, Ryan told himself, Santa would be planning next year's flight before he finished. Jack took a deep breath and swallowed his pride. "Help." Kathy checked her watch.
"That took about 40 minutes longer than I expected."
"I must be slowing down."
"Poor baby, having to drink all that champagne all by himself."
She kissed him on the forehead.
"Screwdriver."
He handed it to her. Kathy took a quick look at the plans.
"No wonder, you dummy. You're using a short screw when you're supposed to use a long one."
"I keep forgetting that I'm married to a high-priced mechanic."
"That's real Christmas spirit, Jack."
She grinned as she turned the screw into place.
a very pretty, smart, and extremely lovable high-priced mechanic. He ran a finger down the back of her neck. That's a little better. Who's better with tools than I am, one-handed? Her head turned to reveal the sort of smile a wife saves only for the husband she loves. Give me another screw, Jack, and I'll forgive you. Don't you think you should finish the dollhouse first? Screw, damn it. He handed her one. You have a one-track gutter, but I forgive you anyway. Thanks. If it didn't work, though, I had something else planned. Oh, did Santa come for me, too? I'm not sure. I'll check in a few minutes. You didn't do bad, considering, his wife said, finishing off the orange plastic roof. That's it, isn't it? Last one, Jack confirmed. Thanks for the assist, babe. Did I ever tell you what... No, I didn't. It was one of the ladies in waiting. I never did find out what they were waiting for. Anyway, this one countess... She was right out of Gone with the Wind, Kathy said with a chuckle. It was his wife's favorite epithet for useless women. She asked me if I did needlepoint. Not the sort of thing you ask my wife. Jack grinned at the windows. And you said, only on eyeballs. A sweet, nasty smile. Ooh, I hope that wasn't over lunch. Jack, you know me better than that. She was nice enough, and she played a pretty good piano. Good as yours? No. His wife smiled at him. Jack reached out to squeeze the tip of her nose. Caroline Ryan, M.D., liberated woman, instructor in ophthalmic surgery, world-famous player of classical piano, wife and mother, takes no crap off anybody. Except her husband. When's the last time I ever won an exchange with you? Jack asked. Jack, we're not in competition. We're in love. She leaned toward him. I won't argue with you on that, he said quietly, before kissing his wife's offered lips. How many people do you suppose are still in love after all the time we've been married? Just the lucky ones, you old fart. All the time we've been married. Jack kissed her again and rose. He walked carefully around the sea of toys toward the tree and returned with a small box wrapped in green Christmas paper. He sat down beside his wife, his shoulder against hers as he dropped the box in her lap. Merry Christmas, Kathy. She opened the box as greedily as a child, but neatly, using her nails to slit the paper. She found a white cardboard box, and inside it, a felt-covered one. This she opened slowly. It was a necklace of fine gold, more than a quarter inch wide, designed to fit closely around the neck. You could tell the price by the workmanship and the weight. Kathy Ryan took a deep breath. Her husband held his. Figuring out women's fashions was not his strongest point. He'd gotten advice from Sissy Jackson and a very patient clerk at the jewelry store. Do you like it? I better not swim with this on. But you won't have to take it off when you scrub, Jack said. Here. He took it from the box and put it around her neck. He managed to clasp it one-handed on the first try. You practiced. One hand traced over the necklace while her eyes looked deeply into his. You practiced, just so you could put it on me yourself, didn't you? For a week at the office. Jack nodded. Wrapping it was a bitch, too. It's wonderful. Oh, Jack. Both her arms darted around his neck, and he kissed the base of hers. Thanks, babe. Thanks for being my wife. Thanks for having my kids. Thanks for letting me love you. Kathy blinked away a tear or two. They gave her blue eyes a gleam that made him happier than any man on earth. Let me count the ways. Just something I saw, he explained casually, lying. It was something he'd seen after looking for 9 hours through 7 stores in 3 shopping malls. And it just said to me, I was made for her.
Jack, I didn't get you anything like...
Shut up. Every morning I wake up and I see you next to me. I get the best present there is.
You are a sentimental jerk right out of some book. But I don't mind.
You do like it? He asked carefully.
You dummy! I love it!
They kissed again. Jack had lost his parents years before. His sister lived in Seattle, and most of the rest of his relations were in Chicago. Everything he loved was in this house. A wife, a child, and a third of another. He'd made his wife smile on Christmas, and now this year went into the ledger book as a success.
About the time Ryan started assembling the dollhouse, 4 identical blue vans left the Brixton prison at 5-minute intervals. For each, the first 30 minutes involved driving through the side streets of suburban London. In each, a pair of police officers sat looking out the small windows in the rear doors, watching to see if there might be a car trailing the truck on its random path through the city. They'd picked a good day for it. It was a fairly typical morning for the English winter. The vans drove through patches of fog and cold rain. There was a moderate storm blowing in from the channel, and best of all, it was dark. The island's northern latitude guaranteed that the sun would not be up for some hours yet, and the dark blue vans were invisible in the early morning. Security was so strict that Sergeant Bob Hyland of C-13 didn't even know that he was in the third van to leave the jail. He did know that he was sitting only a few feet from Sean Miller, and that their destination was the small port of Lymington. They had a choice of 3 ports to take them to the Isle of Wight, and 3 different modes of transport: ordinary ferry, hovercraft, and hydrofoil. They might also have chosen a Royal Navy helicopter out of Gosport, but Hyland needed only a quick look at the starless sky to rule that one out. Not a good idea, he thought to himself. Besides, security is airtight. Not more than 30 people knew that Miller was being moved this morning. Miller himself hadn't known until 3 hours before, and he still didn't know what prison he was heading to. He'd only learn when he got to the island. Embarrassments to the British prison system had accumulated over the years. The old forbidding structures that inhabited such desolate places as Dartmoor in Cornwall had turned out to be amazingly easy to escape from, and as a result 2 new maximum security facilities, Albany and Parkhurst, had been built on the Isle of Wight. There were many advantages to this. An island, by definition, was easier to secure, and this one had only 4 regular entry points. More importantly, this island was a clannish place even by English standards, and any stranger on the loose would at least be noticed, and might even be commented upon. The new prisons were somewhat more comfortable than those constructed in the previous century. It was an accident, but one to which Hyland did not object. Along with the better living conditions for the prisoners came facilities designed to make escape very difficult. Nothing made them impossible, but these new prisons had television cameras to cover every inch of wall, electronic alarms in the most unlikely of places, and guards armed with automatic weapons. Hyland stretched and yawned. With luck, he'd get home by early afternoon and still salvage something of Christmas Day with his family.
"I don't see anything at all to concern us," the other constable said, his nose against the small glass rectangle in the door. "Only a handful of vehicles on the street, and none are following us."
"I shouldn't complain," Hyland observed. He turned around to look at Miller.
The prisoner sat all the way forward on the left-hand bench. His hands were manacled, a chain running from the cuffs to a similar pair on his ankles. With luck and a little assistance, a man so restrained might be able to keep pace with a crawling infant, but he'd have little chance of outracing a 2-year-old. Miller just sat there, his head back against the wall of the van, his eyes closed as the vehicle bounced and jolted over the road. He looked to be asleep, but Hyland knew better. Miller had withdrawn into himself again, lost in some kind of contemplation.
"What are you thinking about, Mr. Miller?"
the policeman wanted to ask. It wasn't that he'd failed to ask questions. Almost every day since the incident on the Mall, Highland and several other detectives had sat across a rugged wood table from this young man and tried to start some kind of conversation. He was a strong one, Highland admitted to himself. He had spoken but one unnecessary word, and that only 9 days before. A jailer with more indignation than professionalism had used the excuse of a plumbing problem in Miller's cell to move him temporarily to another. In the other were two ODCs, as they were called, ordinary decent criminals, as opposed to the political kind that C-13 dealt with. One was awaiting sentencing for a series of vicious street robberies, the other for the gun murder of a shop owner in Kensington. Both knew who Miller was, and hated him enough to look at the small young man as a way to atone for the crimes which they little regretted in any case. When Highland had shown up for yet another fruitless interrogation session, he'd found Miller face down on the floor of the cell, his pants gone, and the robber sodomizing him so brutally that the policeman had actually felt sympathy for the terrorist. The ordinary decent criminals had withdrawn at Highland's command, and when the cell door was opened, Highland had himself picked Miller up and helped him to the dispensary. And there Miller had actually spoken to him as though to another human being. A single word from the puffy split lips. "Thanks." "Cop rescues terrorist," Highland thought to himself. Some headline that would be. The jailer had pleaded innocence, of course. There was a problem with the plumbing in Miller's cell. Somehow the work order had got mislaid, you see, and the jailer had been called to quell a disturbance elsewhere. Hadn't heard a sound from that end of the cell block. Not a sound. Miller's face had been beaten to a bloody pulp, and certainly he'd have no toilet problems for a few more days. His sympathy for Miller had been short-lived. Highland was still angry with the jailer. It was his professionalism that was offended. What the jailer had done was quite simply wrong, and potentially the first step on a path that could lead back to the rack and hot pincers. The law was not so much designed to protect society from the criminals, but more profoundly to protect society from itself. This was a truth that not even all policemen understood fully, but it was the single lesson that Highland had learned from 5 years in the anti-terrorist branch. It was a hard lesson to believe when you'd seen the work of the terrorists. Miller's face still bore some of the marks, but he was a young man, and he was healing quickly. Only for a brief few minutes had he been a victim, a human victim. Now he was an animal again. Highland was hard-pressed to think of him as a fellow man, but that was what his professionalism was for, even for the likes of you. The policeman looked back out the rear window. It was a boring drive, as it had to be, with no radio, no conversation, only vigilance for something that almost certainly wasn't out there. Highland wished that he'd put coffee in his thermos instead of tea. They watched the truck pass out of Woking, then Aldershot and Farnham. They were in the estate country of southern England now. All around them were stately homes belonging to the horse crowd, and the less stately homes of those whom they employed. It was a pity it was dark, Highland thought. This could be a very pleasant drive. As it was, the fog hung in the numerous valleys, and rain pelted the flat metal top of the van, and the van's driver had to be especially careful as he negotiated the narrow, twisting roads that characterized the English countryside. The only good news was the near-total absence of traffic. Here and there Highland saw a solitary light over some distant door, but there was little more than that. An hour later, the van used the M27 motorway to bypass Southampton, then turned south on a secondary, Class A road for Lymington. Every few miles they passed through a small village. There were the beginnings of life here and there. A few bakeries had cars parked outside while their owners got fresh hot bread for the day's dinner. Early church services were underway already, but the real traveling wouldn't start until the sun was up, and that was still over 2 hours off. The weather was worsening. They were only a few miles from the coast now, and the wind was gusting at 30 miles per hour. It blew away the fog,
but also drove sheets of cold rain and rocked the van on its wheels.
"Miserable bloody day to take a boat ride," the other cop in the back commented. "Only supposed to be 30 minutes," Hyland said, his own stomach already queasy at the thought.
Born in a nation of seamen, Bob Hyland detested traveling on the water.
"On a day like this? An hour more like."
The man started humming A Life on the Rolling Wave, while Hyland started regretting the large breakfast he'd fixed before leaving home.
"Nothing for it," he told himself. "After we deliver young Mr. Miller, it's home for Christmas and 2 days off. I've bloody earned it."
30 minutes later, they arrived in Lymington.
Hyland had been there once before, but he remembered more than he could see.
The wind off the water was now a good 40 miles per hour, a full gale out of the southwest. He remembered from the map that most of the boat ride to the Isle of Wight was in sheltered waters, a relative term, but something to depend on nonetheless. The ferry Senlac waited at the dock for them. Only half an hour before, the boat's captain had been told that a special passenger was en route. That explained the 4 armed officers who stood or sat in various places around the ferry. A low-profile operation, to be sure, and it didn't interfere with the ferry's other passengers, many of them carrying bundles whose identity didn't need to be guessed at.
The Lymington to Yarmouth ferry cast off her lines at 8:30 exactly. Hyland and the other officer remained in the van while the driver and another armed constable who'd ridden in front stood outside.
"Another hour," he told himself. "Then a few more minutes to deliver Miller to the prison, and then a leisurely drive back to London. I might even stretch out and get a few winks."
Christmas dinner was scheduled for 4 in the afternoon. His contemplation of that event stopped abruptly. The Senlac entered the Solent, the channel between the English mainland and the Isle of Wight. If these waters were sheltered, Hyland didn't want to think what the open ocean was like. The Senlac wasn't all that large, and the ferry lacked the weatherly lines of a blue water craft. The channel gale was broad on her starboard beam, as were the seas, and the boat was already taking 15-degree rolls.
"Bloody hell," the sergeant observed to himself.
He looked at Miller. The terrorist's demeanor hadn't changed a whit. He sat there like a statue, head still against the van's wall, eyes still closed, hands in his lap. Hyland decided to try the same thing. There was nothing to be gained by staring out the back window. There wasn't any traffic to worry about now. He sat back and propped his feet on the left side bench. Somewhere he'd once read that closing one's eyes was an effective defense against motion sickness. He had nothing to fear from Miller. Hyland was not carrying a gun, of course, and the keys to the prisoner's manacles were in the driver's pocket. So he did close his eyes, and let his inner ear come to terms with the rolling motion of the ferry without the confusion that would come from staring at the unmoving interior of the truck. It helped a little. His stomach soon started to inform him of its dissatisfaction with the current scheme of things, but it didn't get too bad. Hyland hoped that the rougher seas farther out wouldn't change this. They wouldn't. The sound of automatic weapons fire jerked his head up a moment later. The screams came next, from women and children, followed by the rough shouts of men. Somewhere an automobile horn started blaring and didn't stop. More guns started. Hyland recognized the short bark of some detective service automatic, answered at once by the staccato of a submachine gun. It couldn't have lasted more than a minute. The Senlac's own horn started blowing short, loud notes, then stopped after a few seconds while the auto's horn kept going. The screams diminished. No longer shrill cries of alarm, they were now the deeper cries of comprehended terror. A few more bursts of machine gun fire crashed out, then stopped. Hyland feared the silence more than the noise. He looked out the window and saw nothing but a car and the dark sea beyond. There would be more, and he knew what it would be. Uselessly, his hand went inside his jacket for the pistol that wasn't there.
"How did they know? How did the bastards know we'd be here?"
Now came more shouts, the sound of orders that would not be disobeyed by anyone who wanted to live through this Christmas day. Hyland's hands balled into fists. He turned to look again at Miller. The terrorist was staring at him now.
The sergeant would have preferred a cruel smile to the empty expression he saw on that young, pitiless face.
The metal door shook to the impact of an open hand.
"Open the bloody door, or we'll blow it off!"
"What do we do?"
the other cop asked.
"We open the door."
But what? Wait for them to hold a gun at some baby's head?
They've won.
Hyland twisted the handles. Both doors were yanked open. There were three men there, ski masks pulled down over their faces. They held automatic weapons.
"Let's see your guns," the tall one said.
Hyland noted the Irish accent. Not that he was very surprised by it.
"We are both unarmed," the sergeant answered.
He held both hands up.
"Out, one at a time, and flat on the deck."
The voice didn't bother to make any threats. Hyland stepped out of the truck and got to his knees, then was kicked down on his face. He felt the other cop come down beside him.
"Hello, Sean," another voice said. "You didn't think we'd forget you, did you now?"
Still, Miller didn't say anything, Hyland thought in wonderment. He listened to the flat jingle of his chains as he hobbled out of the van. He saw the shoes of a man step to the doors, probably to help him down.
"The driver must be dead," Hyland thought.
The gunman had his keys. He heard the manacles come off, then a pair of hands lifted Miller to his feet. Miller was rubbing his wrists, finally showing a little emotion. He smiled at the deck before looking up at the sergeant. There wasn't much point in looking at the terrorist. Around them he saw at least three men dead. One of the black-clad gunmen pulled the shattered head off a car's wheel, and the horn finally stopped. 20 feet away, a man was grasping at a bloody stomach and moaning. A woman, probably his wife, trying to minister to him. Others lay about on the deck in small knots, each watched by an armed terrorist as their hands sweated on the backs of their necks. There was no unnecessary noise from the gunmen, Hyland noted. They were trained men. All the noise came from the civilians. Children were crying, and their parents were faring better than the childless adults. Parents had to be brave to protect their kids, while the single had only their own lives to fear for. Several of these were whimpering.
"You are Robert Hyland," the tall one said quietly.
"Sergeant Hyland of the famous C-13.
"That's right,"
the policeman answered. He knew that he was going to die. It seemed a terrible thing to die on Christmas Day. But if he was going to die, there was nothing left to lose. He wouldn't plead. He wouldn't beg.
"And who might you be?"
"Sean's friends, of course. Did you really think that we'd abandon him to your kind?" The voice sounded educated despite the simple diction.
"Do you have anything to say?"
Hyland wanted to say something, but he knew that nothing would really matter. He wouldn't even entertain them with a curse, and it came to him that he understood Miller a little better now. The realization shocked him out of his fear. Now he knew why Miller hadn't spoken.
"What damned fool things go through your head at a time like this?" he thought.
It was almost funny, but more than that, it was disgusting.
"Get on with it, and be on your way."
He could only see the tall one's eyes, and was robbed of the satisfaction he might have had from seeing the man's reactions. Hyland became angry at that. Now that death was certain, he found himself enraged by the irrelevant. The tall one took an automatic pistol from his belt and handed it to Miller.
"This one's yours, Sean."
Sean took the gun in his left hand and looked one last time at Hyland.
"I might as well be a rabbit for all that little fucker cares." "I should have left you in that cell," Hyland said, his own voice now devoid of emotion.
Miller considered that for a moment, waiting for a fitting reply to spring from his brain as he held the gun at his hip. A quote from Joseph Stalin came to mind. He raised his gun.
"Gratitude, Mr. Hyland, is a disease of dogs."
He fired 2 rounds from a distance of 15 feet.
"Come on,"
O'Donnell said from behind his mask.
Another black-clad man appeared on the vehicle deck. He trotted to the leader. Both engines are disabled. O'Donnell checked his watch. Things had gone almost perfectly. A good plan it was. Except for the bloody weather. Visibility was under a mile, and...
There it is, coming up aft,
one man called. Patience, lads.
Just who the hell are you?
The cop at their feet asked. O'Donnell fired a short burst for an answer, correcting this oversight. Another chorus of screams erupted, then trailed quickly away into the shriek of the winds. The leader took a whistle from inside his sweater and blew it. The assault group formed up on the leader. There were seven of them, plus Sean. Their training showed, O'Donnell noted with satisfaction. Every man of them stood facing outward around him, gun at the ready in case one of these terrified civilians might be so foolish as to try something. The ferry's captain stood on the ladder 60 feet away, clearly worrying about his next hazard, handling his craft in a storm without engine power. O'Donnell had considered killing all aboard and sinking the boat, but rejected the idea as counterproductive. Better to leave survivors behind to tell the tale, otherwise the Brits might not know of his victory.
Ready,
the man at the stern announced. One by one the gunmen moved aft. There was an 8-foot sea rolling, and it would get worse farther out beyond the shelter of Sconce Point. It was a hazard that O'Donnell could accept more readily than the Senlac's captain.
Go,
he ordered. The first of his men jumped into the 10-meter Zodiac. The man at the controls of the small boat took a lee from the ferry and used the power of his twin outboards to hold her in close. The men had all practiced that in 3-foot seas, and despite the more violent waves, things went easily. As each man jumped aboard, he rolled to starboard to clear a path for the next. It took just over a minute. O'Donnell and Miller went last, and as they hit the rubber deck, the boat moved a lee, and the throttles cracked open to full power. The Zodiac raced up the side of the ferry, out of her wind shadow, and then southwest toward the English Channel. O'Donnell looked back at the ferry. There were perhaps 6 people watching them pull away. He waved to them.
"Welcome back to us, Sean," he shouted to his comrade.
"I didn't tell them a bloody thing," Miller replied.
"I know that."
O'Donnell handed the younger man a flask of whiskey. Miller lifted it and swallowed 2 ounces. He'd forgotten how good it could taste, and the cold sheets of rain made it all the better. The Zodiac skimmed over the wavetops, almost like a hovercraft, driven by a pair of 100-horsepower engines. The helmsman stood at his post midships, his knees bent to absorb the mild buffeting as he piloted the craft through the wind and rain toward the rendezvous. O'Donnell's fleet of trawlers gave him a wide choice of seamen, and this wasn't the first time he'd used them in an operation. One of the gunmen crawled around to pass out life jackets. In the most unlikely event that someone saw them, they would look like a team from the Royal Marines Special Boat Service, running an exercise on Christmas morning. O'Donnell's operations always covered the angles, were always planned down to the last detail. Miller was the only man he'd ever had captured, and now his perfect record was re-established. The gunmen were securing their weapons in plastic bags to minimize corrosion damage. A few were talking to each other, but it was impossible to hear them over the howl of wind and outboard motors. Miller had hit the boat pretty hard. He was rubbing his backside.
"Bloody faggots," he snarled.
It was good to be able to talk again.
"What's that?"
O'Donnell asked over the noise. Miller explained for a minute. He was sure it had all been Hyland's idea, something to soften him up, make him grateful to the cop. That was why both his shots had gone into Hyland's guts. There was no sense in letting him die fast. But Miller didn't tell his boss that. That sort of thing was not professional. Kevin might not approve.
"Where's that Ryan bastard?"
Sean asked.
"Home in America."
O'Donnell checked his watch and subtracted 6 hours. "Fast asleep in his bed, I wager."
"He set us back a year, Kevin,"
Miller pointed out. "A whole bloody year."
"I thought you'd say that."
"Later, Sean." The younger man nodded
and took another swig of whiskey.
Where are we going? Someplace warmer than this.
The sunlight drifted before the wind. As soon as the last terrorist had left, the captain had sent his crew below to check for bombs. They'd found none, but the captain knew that could just mean they were hidden, and a ship was the perfect place to hide anything. His engineer and another sailor were trying to repair one of his diesels, while his three deckhands rigged a sea anchor that now streamed over the stern to steady the ferry on the rolling seas. The wind drove the boat closer to land. That did give them more moderate seas, but to touch the coast in this weather was death for all aboard. He thought he might launch one of his lifeboats, but even that entailed dangers that he prayed he might yet avoid. He stood alone in the pilot house and looked at his radios. Smashed. With them he could call for help. A tug, a merchantman, anything that could put a line on his bow and pull him to safe harbor. But all three of his radio transmitters were wrecked beyond repair by a whole clip of machine gun bullets.
"Why did the bastards leave us alive?"
he asked himself in quiet, helpless rage. His engineer appeared at the door.
"Can't fix it. We just don't have the tools we need. The bastards knew exactly what to break."
"They knew exactly what to do, all right," the captain agreed.
"We're late for Yarmouth. Perhaps..."
"They'll write it off to the weather. We'll be on the rocks before they get their thumbs out." The captain turned and opened a drawer. He withdrew a flare pistol and a plastic box of star shells.
2-minute intervals. I'm going to see to the passengers. If nothing happens, in 40 minutes we launch the boats.
But we'll kill the wounded getting them in.
We'll lose bloody everyone if we don't."
The captain went below. One of the passengers was a veterinarian, it turned out. 5 people were wounded, and the doctor was trying to treat them, assisted by a member of the crew. It was wet and noisy on the vehicle deck. The ferry was rolling 20 degrees, and a window had been smashed by the seas. One of his deck crew was struggling to put canvas over the hole. The captain saw that he would probably succeed, then went to the wounded.
"How are they?"
The veterinarian looked up, the anguish plain on his face. One of his patients was going to die. And the other 4...
"We may have to move them to the lifeboat soon.
It'll kill them. I..."
"Rightio,"
one of them said through his teeth.
"Lie still,"
the doctor said.
"Rightio,"
he persisted. The man's hands were clasping bandages to his abdomen, and it was all he could do not to scream out his agony.
"The bastards wrecked them," the captain said. "I'm sorry. We don't have one." "The truck! A radio in the fucking truck!"
"What?"
"Police!"
Hyland gasped.
"Police van! Prisoner transport! Radio!"
"Holy Jesus!" He looked at the van. The radio might not work from inside the ferry. The captain ran back to the pilot house and gave an order to his engineer. It was an easy enough task. The engineer used his tools to remove the VHF radio from the truck. He was able to hook it up to one of the ferry's antennas, and the captain was using it within 5 minutes.
"Who is this?" the police dispatcher asked. "This is the Senlac, you bloody fool. Our marine radios are out. We are disabled and adrift 3 miles south of Lyle Court, and we need assistance at once."
"Oh, very well. Stand by." The desk sergeant in Lymington was no stranger to the sea. He lifted his telephone and ran his finger down a list of emergency numbers till he found the right one. 2 minutes later, he was back to the ferry.
"We have a tugboat heading towards you right now. Please confirm your position 3 miles south of Lyle Court."
"That is correct, but we are drifting northeast. Our radar is still operating. We can guide the tug in.
For Christ's good sake, tell him to hurry. We have wounded aboard."
The sergeant bolted upright in his chair.
"Say again. Repeat your last."
The captain explained in as few words as possible now that help was en route to his ship. Ashore, the sergeant called his superior, then the local superintendent. Another call went to London. 15 minutes later, a Royal Navy flight crew was warming up a Sea King rescue helicopter at Gosport. They flew first to the Naval Hospital at Portsmouth to pick up a doctor and a medical orderly, then reversed course into the teeth of the gale.
It took 20 dreadful minutes to find her, the pilot fighting his aircraft through the buffeting winds while the co-pilot used the look-down radar to pick the ferry's profile out from the sea return on the scope. That was the easy part. He had to give his aircraft more than 40 knots of forward speed just to hold her steady over the boat, and the wind never stayed the same for more than a few seconds, veering a few degrees in direction, changing 10 knots in speed as he struggled with the controls to maintain something like a hover over her. Aft, the crew chief wrapped the rescue sling around the doctor first, holding him at the open door. Over the intercom, the pilot told the chief to lower away. At least they had a fairly large target. 2 crewmen waited on the top deck of the ferry to receive the doctor. They'd never done it before, but the helicopter crew had, dropping him rapidly to 10 feet over the rocking deck, then more easily the last few feet. 1 crewman tackled the doctor and detached the collar. The medical orderly came next, cursing fate and nature all the way down. He too arrived safely, and the helicopter shot upward to get away from the dangerous surface.
"Surgeon Lieutenant Dilk, Doctor."
"Welcome.
I'm afraid my practice is usually limited to horses and dogs," the vet replied at once. "One sucking chest, the other 3 are belly wounds. One died. I did my best, but..."
There wasn't much else to say.
"Fucking murderers."
The sound of a diesel horn announced the arrival of the tugboat. Lieutenant Dilk didn't bother looking while the captain and crew caught the messenger line and hauled in a towing wire. Together, the doctors administered morphine and worked to stabilize the wounded. The helicopter was already gone southwest, a grimmer purpose to their second mission for the day. Another helicopter, this one with armed Marines aboard, was lifting off from Gosport while the first searched the surface with radar and eyes for a black 10-meter Zodiac-type rubber boat. Orders had come from the Home Office with record speed, and for once they were orders that men in uniform were trained and equipped to handle. Locate and destroy.
"The radar's hopeless," the co-pilot reported over the intercom.
The pilot nodded agreement. On a calm day, they'd have a good chance to pick the rubber boat out, but the return from the confused seas and the flying spray made radar detection impossible.
"They can't have gone too far, and visibility isn't all that bad from up here. We'll do a quartering search and eyeball the bastards."
"Where do we start?"
"Off the Needles, then inward to Christchurch Bay. Then we'll work west if we have to. We'll catch the bastards before they make landfall and have the bootnecks meet them on the beach. You heard the orders."
"Indeed."
The co-pilot activated his tactical navigation display to set up the search pattern. 90 minutes later, it was plain that they'd searched in the wrong place. Surprised, baffled, the helicopters returned to Gosport empty-handed. The pilot went into the ready shack and found 2 very senior police officers.
"Well, we searched from the Needles to Pool Bay. We didn't miss a thing."
The pilot traced his flight path on the chart.
"That type of boat can make perhaps 20 knots in these sea conditions, at most, and then only with an expert crew. We should not have missed them."
The pilot sipped at a mug of tea. He stared at the chart and shook his head in disbelief.
"No way we could have missed them. Not with 2 machines up."
"What if they went seaward? What if they went south?"
"But where? Even if they carried enough fuel to cross the channel, which I doubt, only a madman would try it. There will be 20-foot seas out there, and the gale is still freshening."
"Suicide," the pilot concluded. "Well, we know that they're not madmen. They're too damn smart for that. No way they could have gotten past you, made landfall before you caught up with them."
"Not a chance."
"None."
The flyer was emphatic.
"Then where the hell are they?"
"I'm sorry, sir, but I haven't a clue. Perhaps they sank."
"Do you believe that?" the cop demanded.
"No, sir."
Commander James Owens turned away. He looked out the windows. The pilot was right. The storm was worsening. The phone rang.
"For you, sir."
A petty officer held it up.
"Owens."
"Yes."
His face changed from sadness to rage and back.
"Thank you. Please keep us posted."
That was the hospital. Another of the wounded died.
Sergeant Hyland's in surgery now. One of the bullets hit his spine. That's a total of 9 dead, I believe. Gentlemen, is there anything you can suggest to us? I'd be quite willing to hire a gypsy fortune teller at the moment. Perhaps they made south from the Needles, then curved east and made landfall on the Isle of Wight. Owens shook his head. We have people there, nothing. Then they might have rendezvoused with the ship. There is the usual amount of traffic in the channel. Any way to check that? The pilot shook his head.
No. There's a ship traffic control radar at Dover Strait, but not here. We can't board every ship, can we?
Very well. Gentlemen, thank you for your efforts, particularly getting your surgeon out as quickly as you did. I was told that this action saved several lives. Commander Owens walked out of the building. Those left behind marveled at his self-control. Outside, the senior detective looked up into the leaden sky and swore a mental curse at fortune, but he was too consumed by anger to show what he felt. Owens was a man accustomed to concealing what he thought and felt. Emotions, he often lectured his men, had no place in police work. Of course, that was false, and like many cops, Owens only succeeded in turning his rage inward. That accounted for the packet of antacid pills always in his coat pocket and the quiet spells at home that his wife had learned to live with. He reached in his shirt pocket for a cigarette that wasn't there, then snorted to himself. How did you ever break that habit, Jimmy? He stood alone in the parking lot for a moment, as though the cold rain would dampen his anger. But it only gave him a chill, and he couldn't afford that. He'd have to answer for this. Answer to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. Answer to the Home Office. Someone, not me, thank God, would also have to answer to the Crown. That thought hammered home. He had failed them. He'd failed them twice. He had failed to detect and prevent the original attack on the Mall, and only the incredible luck of that Yank's intervention had saved the day. Then, when everything had subsequently gone right, this failure. Nothing like this had ever happened before. Owens was responsible. It had all happened on his watch. He had personally set up the transport scheme. The method was of his choosing. He had established the security procedures, picked the day, picked the routes, picked the men. All dead now, except for Bob Hyland.
How did they know? Owens demanded of himself. They knew when, they knew where. How did they know?
Well, he told himself, that's one place to start looking. The number of people who had this information was known to Owens. Somehow, it had been leaked. He remembered the report Ashley had brought back from Dublin.
So good. You would not believe it,
that PIRA bastard had said of O'Donnell's intelligence source. Murphy was wrong, the detective thought. Everyone will believe it now. Back to London, he told the driver.
Great day, Jack, Robbie observed on the couch.
Not bad at all, Ryan agreed. Of course, the house looks like a Toys R Us that got nuked. In front of them, Sally was playing with her new toys. She particularly liked the dollhouse, Jack was gratified to see. His daughter was winding down, having gotten her parents up at 7 that morning. Jack and Kathy were winding down also after only 5 hours of sleep. That was a little tough on a pregnant wife, Jack had thought an hour earlier, and he and Robbie had cleared away the dishes, now being processed by the dishwasher in the kitchen. Now their wives were on the other couch talking while the menfolk sipped at some brandy. Not flying tomorrow? Jackson shook his head. The bird went tits up. Take another day or so to fix. Besides, what's Christmas without a good brandy? I'll be back in the simulator tomorrow, and regs don't prevent me from drinking before I do that. I don't strap in until 3 tomorrow. I ought to be fairly sober by then.
Robbie'd had one glass of wine with dinner, and had limited himself to only one Hennessy.
God, I need a stretch.
Jack stood up and beckoned his friend to the stairs. How late were you up last night, sport?
I think we hit the sack a little after 2.
Robbie checked to see that Sally was out of earshot.
Being Santa is a bitch, isn't it? If you can put all those toys together...